This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We are on remote. Today, Henry Crawford is our guest. He comes to poet from lawyer, from technology, from multimedia, from being an active citizen in the Republic of Poetry. And here is Henry with an opening poem.
Thank you very much, Grace. It's quite an honor to be here. I wanted to start with a love poem, a mature love poem. This is The Distance. Now, it was only this morning I saw my wife's face coming up through the skin, covering her bony skull. The way flesh conceals or concedes the width of what some might call the personality and others the soul, or the way we might think of a rainforest as a certain kind of geography. And we might also see the trees everywhere breathing for us, like the porous hollows of her skin, the way it knows how to fold and unfold itself, so steady and yet always giving something new, like an ice floe bundling and unbundling, the same way a bear might clutch and release a cub. She walked into breakfast this morning, her eyes crinkly, and I detected a certain happy thought just coming to the surface near the turn of her mouth. And I enjoyed her pleasure from the other side of the eternal distance we have learned to share, the way a sea otter or seal will come up with a face full of water to teach us yet another kind of happiness.
Now that is a beautiful poem, and it's a narrative poem. And Henry is known for many things. He's also known for the way he presents poems on the page, very unusual. We'll talk about that. He also has made his poems into video, and we will also venture into that subject. But for now, another poem. Henry Crawford is our guest on The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress on remote.
And this is a poem, it's my homage to DC, in which the metaphor is DC as a pinball machine. This is DC pinball. Shot. Out of Fort Stevens cannon, the ball caroms up Georgia Avenue for 50 quick points off the Leisure World Globe, ricocheting through the strip mall stores of Aspen Hill to spin jauntily down the Starbucks corridor of Connecticut Avenue, picking up dollars in the doorways of K Street law firms, lighting up lobbyists for cash and prizes, whirling around the tidal basin only to be trapped in Jefferson's Dome, then loosed by a flip of the Washington Monument, knocking the ball into the reflecting pool where the poor once stood waiting for their own bonus points at the lap of Lincoln, who kicks the ball around the outer rings of DuPont Circle, up Mass Ave past the Naval-Gazing Observatory, picking up gargoyle points off the walls of the Washington Cathedral, then up the Neiman Marcus Highway of Wisconsin Avenue, past the grave of Scott Fitzgerald, before falling into the ancient waters of the Rock Creek, now flowing silently by a pickup b-ball game at Candy Cane City, untouched and gaining speed as it sails past the proud shores of P Street Beach to slip through the hands of white-gloved Georgetown, unable to make the save as the ball drops into the Potomac on its way out to the big sea that knows nothing of us.
That thing moved. Gotta say, that thing moved. Now, this is an example of one of your venturesome poems where you apply brackets to different words. Will you please describe for the audience what you're doing to that poem?
Okay, so let me try to give a little background there. At the time I came into poetry, about 12 years ago, I was working as a coder. I was writing code in as what I had done for the last 20 years, writing code in various web shops. I was writing almost, a couple hundred lines of code a day. Think about that. Every day, a couple hundred lines have to be done. There's no work around that. You have to keep writing. And so I got very familiar with the way I like to structure things and the way, and lines, line breaks, and white space just didn't do it for me the way it just wasn't the same thing. Well, lines and white space mean a different thing in computer code than they do on the page. So for me, As I was trying to organize my material, and to this day still, I feel very comfortable ending a thought with a bracket, beginning it with another one or ending it with another one, and then going on and doing various, using symbols from the keyboard to break things up the way you would do it with code. So that is really where that comes about.
It's very attractive. It adds to the aesthetic. But how do you know which words to bracket?
You know, that's the funny thing. I let that process happen almost the way I used to do it with code. It's like a visceral process. All of a sudden, I'll be in one mindscape with a phrase or with a turn of words. And then all of a sudden, I'll be in another one. And I'll say, oh, this is where one begins and where another one ends. Sometimes it's like that. Sometimes it's rhythmically. We'll do a poem later on, which is a very, very, where I used it rhythmically.
Well, let's hear another poem.
Yeah,
I have to tell them who you are. You have been a winner or among winners in several contests, national ones. Your poem, The Fruits of Famine, won first prize at the World Food Poetry Competition, and that was really competitive. You've also been placing as a winner in the winning writer's The Wurkle Flump humor yeah. contest. We will hear that poem too. You had a poem called Gettysburg Auto Tour as a finalist for the Deanna Tully Multimedia Prize. We will talk about that. But right now, Henry Crawford is going to read a poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
I live in Maryland, where we are graced and blessed with a wonderful countryside. And I do a lot of riding in that countryside, and I ride by a lot of farms when I go out there. This is driving by a farm at a distance. A Pennsylvania farm knows you're just driving through. They see your rolled up windows and let you go. I sometimes imagine waking up to a table of butter and milk, my imaginary wife adorned in gingham. Outside, imagined animals are waiting for me to imagine them too. There might be pigs, but more likely chickens. I imagine myself putting on my farmer's suit to scatter some feed. I believe there are machines that I imagine need fixing. Heat of the day glistening on my soaked bandana. My imaginary son in the next field, all blonde cowlick, stooped over a row of young corn. Maybe he's a 4-H club hero or a desk-bound nerd who wants none of this. But there's always an imaginary dock, sometimes going out upon a useless pond, sometimes buried in the woods by a dragonfly creek. I am afraid of autumn. It's then I imagine the evening will appear to me. My plain wife listening to the radio, imagined music in the farmhouse air. This is the night I will stay on the dock, no one calling, lowering myself into the flotsam of leaf dust and spent butterfly wings to fall with the stars under the surface of imaginary water.
That is Henry Crawford at his lyrical best, one of my very favorite poems. And that became a video.
Yes, it did.
And tell us how that happened.
Yes, it did. As I said, I like to bike in the countryside, and that's where I see a lot of this scenery. So I was out on a bike trip last spring, and I took a ton of photos with my camera all over the Maryland countryside, and I built a slideshow, and I liked the slideshow, and then I read the poem into a video, and then I had my brother do the soundtrack to it, and it was just a wonderful thing to reconnect with my brother, who's an electronic musician and a tremendously creative force. And so we put our forces together and came up with the video, Driving by a Farm.
Where can people see that, Henry?
The best place to see that is to come to my Binary Planet website and go to the video section, and you'll see all of my videos. And it's binaryplanet.com, which is the website for my book, The Binary Planet.
And tell us the title of your other book.
My other book was American Software, which was my first book. And that was a book that really explored especially a lot of the symbolism, a lot of these using of symbols. And it looks a lot very codish. In fact, the first poem in American Software is called Hello World, which is that's the traditional programmer's way of writing the first thing that you do in a programming language. The first program you always write is called Hello World.
Oh, that is fabulous, Henry. If you can't beat technology, then appropriate it. Turn it into poetry. Make it last. Let's hear another poem.
Okay, so this is the one that placed as a runner-up in the humor contest. It's what I call serious humor, and it was a way of talking about my mom. This is making an auto insurance claim. My side view mirror got whacked by an unknown driver, so I called an 800 number to make a claim. And I was put on hold, listening to a song with a strange xylophone solo. And they broke in every 3 minutes to thank me for my patience. Now, I don't play the xylophone, but I was in a band called Curb Your Dog with a drummer called Nutty Chuck. And he knew three notes on the xylophone, C, C sharp, and D. He could play them fast or slow, but we had to kick him out. So Nutty Chuck and a guy named Horse moved to California with the xylophone. And around this time, the phone was asking if I would like to take a survey at the completion of the call, after which the song with the xylophone came back. There's always a tendency to account for things. My Aunt Grace, who was not my real aunt, learned to play the flute at the age of 98. I remember asking her about my mother. As she talked, she would toot a note or two. She told me my mother, toot toot, would never marry my dad, toot toot. He would never leave his wife, toot toot. So all the children, toot toot toot, would be illegitimate, toot toot. My mother almost took her own life, toot, when she learned she was pregnant with me, toot toot. Grace said I should be grateful they didn't have abortion in those days. I tooted back. I'd be good either way. Toot to you. And now the phone began asking questions. I gave a 7 to the service rep. I gave 0 for the time on hold. I gave my mom an 8. Gave myself a 9 for being patient and 10 for the song with the xylophone solo.
That is a work of art. That is so wonderful. There's so many layers to that, as well as a soundtrack. So, that also is bracketed. I believe every word in that poem is bracketed, if I remember.
Every phrase in that one, and that really helped me write that layered style, because it was like being almost like when you're coding and you're going to have a lot of different messages and things coming in on you. It helped me to get the momentum to talk about my days as an early rock and roller. It got me to, there was a band called Curb Your Dog, and we didn't have a xylophone in it, but it allowed me to talk about that, allowed me to talk about this call. It actually happened, that somebody whacked my car, a lot of these things. But most importantly, it allowed me to go back to something I've had to think about all my life. I was born out of wedlock. In those days, they called it illegitimate. Nowadays, you just call them children. But in those days, it was a lot of pressure on her, and she decided to have it, but it could have been the other way. So when my aunt said, yeah, I'm glad I didn't have abortion, I had to reconcile that my life could have gone the other way, and that I would have had to have respected her voice, and I do. And that was one of those things that I had that I've come to. I'd be fine either way. That's the heart of that poem.
Henry, you didn't really have an Aunt Grace.
No. Her name was, I won't tell her what her name was, but I named her Grace, not knowing you or anything, but I named her that.
But I like the way you add that editorial comment in the poem. It enriches it. My Aunt Grace, that wasn't really my Aunt Grace.
She wasn't really my aunt.
You have a lot of tricks going on. You have a lot of layers going on. But under that is, I think under the surface of that, there is something painful to me. Yeah. And yet, what is comedy but failed tragedy? I mean, that's what comedy is. So hear more from Henry Crawford. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress.
Okay, this is that one that you mentioned, the winner of the hunger contest, the World Hunger Contest. And this is The Fruits of Famine. On those nights, we traced the shapes of fruit until the dark became our eyes. On those nights, we left our fields unhearing the crack of broken roots, the silence of dying ground. On those nights, twilight filled the deserts of our crossing with the vermilion breath of watermelon. On those nights, the stars seeded the skies above the camp. Jackfruit guards stood still as celery stalks. On those nights, we dreamed, like you, of strawberry days on porcelain plates. On those nights, I made an apple out of sand and watched it blow away.
If you were the judge, why would you have chosen that poem as first place winner of a national contest?
Well, I don't put myself in the shoes of judges, but what I liked about that particular one and what was the I knew I wanted to use these fruit images, and but just to keep sharpening them as I wrote this poem, I wanted to sharpen them and make them mean each one more meaningful, and yet at the same time I wanted to tell the story of somebody on maybe a desert ground, or as a migrant person moving somewhere in the world who's hungry and trying to find food while we have strawberry days on porcelain plates.
You are gifted with language. You're gifted with language. And I'll bet you came out that way. Let's have two poems together and we'll tell you.
Then
know a taste of Henry Crawford.
Okay. Well, this is a poem that reflects, I dropped out of school when I was 16. So I wasn't that gifted. I dropped out of high school at 16 and I came from a working class background. I just started working in the factories. And I worked there a couple of years. So I had that factory behind me and I've never forgotten that. So this is an updated factory poem that I sort of updated for the modern days, but it's called Day Shift at the Hula Hoop Factory. Jack and I make plastic rings out of reconditioned railroad waste, talking hoops with pre-recorded messages like stand clear, voiced by silver-plated microchips embedded in miniaturized ceramic networks etched into poly-tri-coated surfaces. And it took months to find this job. And even now, we're both electronically scanned for contaminants at breakfast and given steaming buckets of Uncle Al's flaming chicken for dinner. And we came to this town because we heard it was good for hula hoops. Jack said, we'll get in on the ground floor. But the walking foreman said, not so fast, Buster. So today, I'm working on a 10x10 military-grade hula hoop. First, I stretch my arms in a circular motion, grabbing whatever loose threads come burning off the rim. Then I loop backwards using a forward motion. But if I fail to grasp the right clocking flange, it all comes down melting onto the floor, and I'll be docked for the parts. But if it goes just right, it's like a yellow heaven of rainbow sparks exploding in cotton candy vapors, smooth like a Don Garlitz rail job, all metal flake paint and cuckoo canary yellow. And I'm happy, like getting a family-sized bag of Cheezies or an extra 5 minutes of Christmas.
Henry, was that really a hula hoop factory?
No, I worked in another kind, but it was the factory. It was, you can learn a factory job in a couple of days, and yet I do this for a couple of years. So I used the time after I had mastered the thing, I used the time to learn how to really appreciate reading. And I must have read 300 or 400 books while I was doing that job. And by the end of it, I realized, you know, I think I could probably do well in college. And surprise, surprise, I did. I got out of there. I went to the City University of New York and matriculated and changed my life in a completely different way.
And then did you go to law school?
Well, yes, because, you know, when I graduated, I did academically very well, well enough to come to a pretty good school like George Washington University. And being a poor kid, I wasn't, you know, even though I loved the humanities, which is what I had majored in, you know, I wanted a firm footing in the middle class. And to me, that best ticket was being a lawyer, which I did. So I became a Washington lawyer.
Is that the best way to join the bourgeoisie?
Well, that's the way it occurred to me back then. And as you can see from my life's journey, there's been many, many turns that I had to take as I engaged in that
life. And you practiced law?
I practiced law for 15 years.
Let's have another poem, and then we're going to pursue this deeply.
All right, this is a poem that I gave as a wedding gift to my friend Victor, who I was working with at the Treasury as a consultant. And I wanted to give them as a wedding gift that would pinpoint in time, it would stick a pinpoint in time, the summer of 2017 when they were married. The best part about this poem that I love to read is that many of the things are already disappearing, but they will always know by looking at this poem when they were married. This is when Victor and Lyndon got married. It was the rain bomb days of August in the age of Despacito, 10 years after the rise of modern food trucks, during the penultimate season of Game of Thrones. 951 years since the Battle of Hastings, just days before the North American eclipse, in the era of John Oliver, a year after La La Land, when Travelocity was riding high but Progressive Flow was slowly losing ground. These good years of cold brew and meal pal, when online deliveries were just taking hold, 17 years before Social Security was set to run out, as cracks were spreading along Greenland's mountains. We still wore earbuds. Frank Underwood was president, waiting for the 2020 campaign. There were snow leopards in the wild. It was the age of Netflix, HBO, Amazon, Google, years before our inevitable collision with Andromeda, when the sun was still burning hot in middle age with so much atomic fuel to burn. There were blueberries in our salads, strawberries in our Froger. They made a table for us. It was summer.
Yep, there are certainly points on the map.
Yep.
Victor and Lyndon will always know when they got married. There were such, name a couple of the things that were significant in that poem.
Okay, so do you remember the eclipse? How big that was that summer?
Yes.
So the eclipse got in there. And I had to throw in the Battle of Hastings because I do believe, you know, being an English speaker and speaking English the way we do, that whole moment in English history is very, very important. So I wanted to get that in. And Game of Thrones, I remember that a couple of years ago.
And was that when Netflix started?
Yeah.
And Amazon?
Netflix and all those that had started earlier, but they were just really coming into being, as was the 17 years before Social Security and food trucks. So Victor and I used to go down to the food trucks all the time down at 14th Street in D.C. when we were working together. So I knew that would always remind him of that. So I put in all of these like little dashes, but it's a way that these things are disappearing and will disappear, just like everything around us. Someday they'll say, Netflix, what's that? HBO, what's that?
Poetry is so important. It really footnotes our culture. I mean, even though this is lighthearted, it is beautiful, it is bracketed, it's innovative, it's heart-filled, it really marks a little indentation in our civilization. So that is why we do it. Did you actually read that at the wedding?
No, but I gave them a special copy of it, and because they got married, it was one of these destination weddings, and it was at a distance. Uh-huh. And so, but I gave them a copy of it, and the two of them, I know that they love them because I've spoken with them afterwards, and they have kept this, and it is.
There could not be a piece of Lennox or a piece of silver to match it. Believe me, so. How do you think that the law factors into your love or understanding of language, which is so meticulous? It didn't get in the way. It didn't make you wooden. How did the law help you to poetry?
Well, I think the law, I think the thing that I most took away from law was a responsibility as a language user.
Whoa.
We are, as language users, we are responsible. So when I write a poem, I am responsible to myself to be honest, to reflect who I am, to put my Henry Crawford flag wherever that is. Mm-hmm. I have to be, and I'm also responsible to the people who hear it, that they will understand what I'm doing. That though a lot of it will be shaded, there'll be mystery, there'll be these other elements. I have to be a responsible language user and use language to do good rather and to be kind rather than to be harsh or to be.
I love that. Don't we wish that all the law were kind?
Yeah, but
of the law were kind. But I do know many lawyers who are poets, so that they're not averse to lyricism at all. And all of the threads in your life have come together to make you really an exceptional human being. I mean, just the different occupations you've had, your love and your lust for reading and for the humanities, it must be nice to be you.
Well, now it is. Today, in a half hour, who knows? We only, days are the clay which we use to make our lives. And they're all a little different. They're all a little different, weird, whatever. But as I said, to stick my flag in my Henry Crawford Hill, that's one of the things. And to be responsible, to be kind and loving to the people around me, to try to be as...
And you have your own planet. What more do you want?
They've got it, right?
Let's have another poem.
This next poem, let me do the black hole, in fact. Somehow I had skipped that around here. Okay, the black hole. This is a good poem. This is a poem that I dedicated to Stanley Plumlee, the Maryland poet laureate. I think before...
You work with him?
Yes, I took courses at the Writers' Center with him. And he is a mentor, I think, to almost all of the poets that I know in D.C. He is a force in this area for having taken on a lot of the poets that I know and who work in the D.C. area. So he died right around the time that the first picture was ever taken of a black hole. I think it was like either the day before or the day after. These two events happened. And in my mind, they sort of coupled. And so I wrote this poem to commemorate both events. And so this is Black Hole Ekphrastic. And it has an epigraph. The dark itself, not dark enough, from the poem At Night by Stanley Plumlee. Dog's eye darkness, suspended spider-like in your starry black bag, scoping all comers like a blind decoy eyeing its prey, gaslighting all who make it to your edge until another sun is made mortal by your pull. Seeing is never believing. You lay waiting like a cold cup of black coffee, shining, lightless. Your space, your time. I can only hypothesize your insides from the finite horizon of eyes, but touch. You offer a rim of sealed skin, then nothing.
Oh, I know he hears you. I do know that. And you are now working with another wonderful poet, David Keplinger.
Yes, I am. And he is...
He's another mentor worth mentioning.
He is my mentor. And this is the most natural thing, is one of my favorite influences. I am very influenced by him. He's got another book out that's going to be out in the next month, and I've taken a look at it.
And he'll be on The Poet and the Poem, too. Nobody escapes this. And it burns to say goodbye, but would you set up that poem?
All right. So this has got a very good story that goes with it. I wrote the poem in a flash after I read in the New York Times about this fellow, Jose Villas, who was executed in Texas by lethal injection. And so it was a controversial method. And so they asked him, how does it feel as he was dying? And he said, it does kind of burn goodbye. And that was his last words. Well, when I read that, I was on the metro. And when I read that, like every poetic alarm bell started ringing in my head. And I wrote the poem pretty much in a flash in the next day or two. And then I sent a copy of the poem to the Supreme Court reporter at the New York Times, Linda Greenhouse. Just, I looked up her email and just sent it to her as a lark. Well, she replied in it must have been 2 hours, faster than my friends do. And she replied and she said, Henry, she goes, that is a wonderful poem. She helped me edit it because in those days I was doing, I was more fanciful in those days with more whimsical touches. And, you know, she said, you know, you don't need this footnote. You don't need that. You don't need that. She goes, keep the brackets. She goes, that's okay. But she said, that is a wonderful poem. And it went on to be a runner-up for Boulevard's Emerging Poet in 2014. And so I got into the same volume with Charles Simic and Billy Collins. And Crawford comes right after Collins. And so
Not bad. No. Collins comes before Crawford.
Yeah. So I was very, very happy to. He came right before me, and I was
he should
very.
Be so honored.
I was very. So, but it was just a case of, you know, it caught my fire, and but it's one I close almost all of my readings with, and every time I do that, it's a way of saying to Jose, your words live on. When you say something like it does kind of burn goodbye, that's not forgotten. Jose, your words will live on. And I close all of my poems with this. And his words were, it does kind of burn. Goodbye. He was burning, and he was trying to tell us something. He was on fire, and he was trying to be objective. It burns. And he was trying to let us know that it does burn, that it was burning. And that's what it does. It burns. And he was trying to tell us, I'm on fire. And he was letting us know, it feels like I'm burning. And he was trying to lessen the burning, kind of. So he used those words, kind of. Yes, he was burning, but only kind of. Like having kind of a dream, or being kind of awake, like being kind of happy, like feeling kind of blue, like being kind of on fire. And he was kind of saying goodbye. And he was trying to tell us something about saying goodbye. And he had this word. And it only takes one word to say goodbye. And he was trying to tell us goodbye. And he was burning. And he was kind of leaving. And he was trying to tell us something, and some of them heard him say goodbye.
The voice of Henry Crawford. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forestwood Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We want to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, with additional support from the Sinipet Fund and Diane Wilbon Parks. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.